We talk about the markets on this podcast, but ultimately it's investors who put their money into the markets to improve their financial well-being. And as much as stocks and bonds go up and down in value, it's the idea that investing is just one of many components to an overall financial plan. And this overall strategy or approach combined with proper tax planning can really make a huge difference to reaching one's financial goals. And as we unpack today's topic of getting ready for year end, it is really important to ensure that you, the investor, have sound advice when doing this. And this is a big part of what the Advanced Financial Planning Team at IG do every day. I'm Philip Peterson, Chief Investment Strategist at IG Wealth Management. Join me each week as we discuss the trends dominating the investment landscape. Today, we're going to be navigating tax and advanced financial planning on the living market. Welcome to the Living Market. I'm very pleased to be joined by a colleague, Aurel Corcel. He is the Assistant Vice President, Tax and Estate Planning with the Advanced Financial Planning Team at IG Wealth. Aurel, welcome to the Living Markets.
Thank you for the invitation to join you.
Yeah, let me just give a little bit of an introduction again to you. So you are a chartered professional accountant specializing in tax and estate planning for high net worth individuals and corporations. You bring a strategic focus on retirement and tax optimization. Like myself and my team, you are regularly in the media providing advisor training on retirement taxation in addition, and all with the goal of helping clients build financial plans to be better aligned to their long-term goals. Now, is that a fair description of what the value is that you bring to not only IG, but our clients, Aurel?
I believe it is. I mean, my focus is really helping our advisors help our clients maximize the value of their plan, whether it's from a tax perspective, estate planning perspective, because there's many areas of financial planning to consider. And investment planning, which is your area of expertise, is but one of those elements of a full financial plan. So I try to round out some of the other aspects to help our clients really achieve those objectives.
Well, and like I said to your colleague, Christine, you know, everyone seems to think that investing is the most important element of it. In fact, you know, while I like to think that's true, it's actually not the case. It's the planning element around it. And as the saying goes, there's only two things certain in life, death and taxes. And we want to try and minimize the impact of either as best we can. But before we go a little bit deeper into the whole taxation and planning side of things, you know, I just want to do a quick recap on where we've come. We're nearing the end of 2023. We're starting to think ahead to 2024, and it has been quite a year. Now, I'm reminded of the famous Lenin quote. That's Vladimir Lenin, not John Lennon. And he said, "There are decades where nothing happens, and there are weeks where decades happen." And you know, perhaps that is very, very much the case for 2023. So just to recap a few things that we've seen over the course of the year and how it's impacted the markets, and then we'll get into the more important planning element of it. If we go back to the early part of the year started off quite well. You know, we came out of the correction or bear market of 2022 with stronger markets, but then we had a bit of a banking catastrophe in the United States with Silicon Valley Bank failing. That followed with Signature Bank failing and a couple other banks needed to be bailed out. We've had the collapse of FTX, the crypto exchange, the fall of Sam Bankman-Fried, and how that has kind of worked its way through the markets from crypto investing and so on. We've seen inflation come down, but it feels, and this is the challenge, I think, when we get to things like inflation, while the rate of change has eased, prices are still much higher than where we were in 2019. And we don't see deflation over the near term. And likewise, interest rates that have moved up very, very strongly over the past year and a half to 2 years has really impacted Canadians with respect to the mortgage. And a recent Ipsos study shows that 62% of Canadians expect housing affordability to worsen in 2024. And that's the impact of renewing your mortgage and renewing it into a higher interest rate environment. Now, many market participants have been talking about recession for quite some time. We're not entirely of that view. We think that The U.S. economy is actually much stronger and more resilient than some have perhaps given it credit, whereas Canada is likely in a recession by our view. And in fact, Ipsos has shown that 60% of Canadians believe that Canada is already in a recession. We would agree with that. And this is the nuance of what we're seeing in the global economy, where you have an economy like Canada that is facing tougher economic conditions because of the interest rate environment, whereas in the United States or Europe, they've actually managed better through it because the higher interest rates aren't impacting mortgages there as quickly as it is in Canada with renewals coming up, 5 years or less. And then lastly, of course, geopolitics continues to drive headlines, whether it's the war in Ukraine, tensions between China and the United States, or the conflict most recently in the Middle East between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. And let's not forget that next year we're heading into an election year in the United States. So a lot's been going on. We have a lot to look forward to. But how, when we think about this, does it really impact our planning? I mean, interest rates obviously does, but all the other stuff is just noise. When you think about financial planning, what are the important elements to it that you address with clients?
I would say that there are quite a few. And when looking at what you just discussed now, there's the elements of, for example, higher inflation and how that impacts people's plans. Because if you're in a higher inflation environment, that means that you may be having to make a few tougher decisions, let's say, that probably are short-term decisions that may have longer-term implications. And even for those currently maybe who are retired and maybe on a fixed income, for example, and don't have that inflation protection that you talked about earlier, where inflation has been on the rise. And I'll let you speak to where you think that's going in the future. But that inflation can eat into your purchasing power. It impacts everyone. But if you're on a fixed income like a retiree, it may impact you even more. And that could mean maybe having to dip a little bit more into your savings, a little more than you'd planned possibly. And of course, that can have an impact on the sustainability of your income over time. So that's certainly a big factor. You mentioned also where interest rates are, where they've been, where they're going. High interest rates obviously carry their own significance when you look at your financial planning. And if you're carrying debt, that means a higher cost. And when it comes to a comprehensive financial plan, every increase in interest rates that we've seen have meant that you, again, possibly have had to make tougher decisions and maybe prioritize today at the expense of saving for tomorrow. And there's how can I plan for that today, but how can I maybe make adjustments going forward to make sure my financial plan stays on track?
We're coming up to year end. And as I mentioned in the early part of my summary, the year started off well. And in general, I would say that 2023 has been a better year than 2022. Both in terms of fixed income as well as equities. In general, equity markets are higher than where we were at the start of the year. We have seen a nice little rally here, post a very brief correction in September and early October. But are there things that, we should be considering as we come to the end of the year with respect to our portfolios from a planning perspective?
Yeah, as you mentioned, the markets have gone up and down as they always do throughout the year, and that brings its own planning opportunities, let's say. So for example, your portfolio may be sitting on some investments that are not in a gain position, so they're in a loss position. And this is the time of year where the term tax loss selling is often thrown out. And tax loss selling is the concept of if I have investments that are sitting in a loss position, maybe I purposely realize those losses, whether it's to move to something else, rebalance my portfolio, or simply to make sure that I maximize the value of those losses when it comes to my tax plan. Because if I realize a loss on my investment, that's called a capital loss. And if you realize gains on your investments within the same years, of course, those are capital gains. And you can use your losses to offset gains. So if you had gains in 2023 that you realized, they would be taxable on your tax return that you're going to prepare in the spring. If you realize some losses, you can use those to offset those gains you realized in 2023 and minimize the taxes you pay this year. That said, any excess loss, so if you have more losses than you have gains in the current year, they can be carried back up to 3 years to recover taxes you paid on gains in those prior years. So we're sitting now in 2023. That means you can go back with losses to 2022, 21, and 20. So 2020 this is the last year you could realize losses to go get some taxes you paid back in 2020. 2020 being essentially the first full year of COVID, as we all remember in the back of our minds. And maybe you look at that time where I know the markets really fluctuated early in that year, but you may have triggered some gains or realized some gains before the markets went down, or maybe you bought when the markets were down and then sold the gains later on that year, realizing losses this year that exceed your gains and carrying back to 2020 is actually your last opportunity to recover some of those taxes you may have paid. So that's a great opportunity to look at if you're sitting on some investments with some accrued losses. And then if you have net capital losses that exceed your gains in those 3 years or even this year, you can carry them forward indefinitely. So they're not lost in any way. And you can actually use them in the future. And because they're not lost, that's if you look at it from your investment perspective, which is more your area, Philip, essentially you can use those losses in the future and let that loss not necessarily impact what you're doing with your investment portfolio, knowing the loss can be used at some point when you realize some gains. So you can rebalance based on what you think you should be doing from an investment perspective without that overtone of taxes hovering above you.
Yeah, and I just want to highlight that again, because that's something that I hadn't utilized until last year, the going back and reevaluate, are using capital losses from 2022 to offset the capital gains of 2021, and ended up with a very nice return. As you and many others may remember, 2021 was a very, very strong year for the markets. We had that very strong rebound. And at the end of the year, many investors had significant gains. And then in 2022, with the bear market, you're sitting there saying, I just paid all this on taxes last year and I didn't even get the benefit of it this year. Well, you know, went back, refiled, and I would say reclaimed all those taxable gains that I paid, and made a big difference, made a really big difference. And that's something that I think, as he said, you know, this year, you can only go back to 2020. So make sure you use that.
Yeah, I fully agree. And this is where a lot of people overlook that, because the past is the past. You're looking into the future. And this is where working with an advisor who just simply triggers that reflex to always go, okay, look at your past returns. Let's take a look at the last 3 years and let's see if there's any opportunities to recover some of the taxes you paid in the past. And this is an often overlooked opportunity, let's say, because people are thinking, well, maybe I can trigger some gains to offset trigger some losses to offset current gains. They forget that, hey, maybe it's an opportunity to use those losses and go get some taxes that I already paid, not just reduce this year's taxes.
Now let's think about it the other way in terms of gains, because you triggered something else in my head. When we think at the end of the year or you know, any point in the year, in terms of philanthropy and giving, and you know, I donate to charities, and many Canadians donate to charities. But what is probably the most tax efficient way to do this as an investor and a philanthropist?
Well, there's certainly a big opportunity if you are an investor and a philanthropist, or even if you just make the occasional donation to certain charities. I'll get to the whole using public traded securities as donations in kind in a minute. But just to start at the basics, where you're looking at any donation to a registered charity provides a valuable tax credit on your tax return. And that tax credit comes with a lot of planning. It's one of the tax credits where you probably can plan the most. And I'll give you a few examples. For example, the first $200 donations that you claim on your tax return receive a much lower tax credit rate than amounts above $200. The only exception would be Alberta, who brought in some legislation that are actually giving you very nice rates on the first 200. But general rule is most provinces, the first 200, you basically get your tax credit in most provinces at the lowest marginal tax rate in your province. Anything above 200 will get a much higher tax credit rate. And in most provinces, that'll be your top tax bracket. So the spread is probably anywhere between 20 and 30% more on your tax credit on a donation above combined donations above 200 versus those totaling below 200. So one strategy, for example, would be I'm sitting at the end of this year. I often make donations throughout the year, and I'll make some in January, February. Why not accelerate those donations into the latter part of 2023? You get a bigger donation, hopefully above 200, you get a bigger credit, and I'm sure your charity will be more than happy to receive the money earlier and use those for their benefit. So I think that's certainly one planning opportunity that exists to maximize the donation credit. Another one is donations made by spouses or common law partners can be combined onto a single tax return. So if you're both spouses are making their respective donations to their respective causes, when it comes to preparing your tax return, by putting them all together on one return, that means you'll hit the $200 threshold faster. And much more of that amount will go above 200 and get the much higher credit. Again, Alberta being your outlier here, where you want to probably split the first 200, then try to maximize the value on one return. But little things like that can make a significant difference. Now, back to your original point, which was if I'm an investor and I've got publicly traded securities or mutual funds that may have accrued gains, should I, for example, cash those in, realize my gains, then donate the money to my favorite charity, or should I possibly make arrangements with the organization to transfer those in kind? In kind being transfer the shares or the mutual fund units to the charity itself directly without selling them first. And the answer would be yes, a definite yes. Because if I trigger the gains first, that means I'm going to realize the gains and 50% of my capital gains are taxable on my tax return. If I instead transfer those securities in kind to the charitable organization, then the inclusion rate is essentially zero, which means I pay no tax on the gain. But either way, I'm still getting the same charitable receipt for the fair market value of the donation. So simply making a donation in kind versus making a donation in cash is significant because I have no tax to pay on the accrued gain versus paying tax on the accrued gain if I do make the cash donation.
So I want to be clear on that, because I think this is very, very worthwhile strategy. If, let's say, I was going to donate $5,000 to a charity rather than cut a check, if I look through my non-registered portfolio and see an investment that has significant capital gains, it would be better for me from an after-tax perspective to take $5,000 of that, donate it in kind, and then avoid the capital gains tax and get the charitable contribution tax credit.
100%. Essentially, even if you have the cash in your example, I could write the check without cashing that investment in. I'm still better off because if I make the cash and I need money later on, I'm going to have to trigger the gain, pay tax on it, versus making that donation today with that security with accrued gains. I will never pay tax on that gain. And then the charity will simply turn around in all likelihood and sell it themselves. So they're indifferent. They're basically getting the cash either way. And you're getting much better tax treatment on both the combination of the donation and the gain that would have otherwise been taxed.
And then I want to get into there's a third element. Now, some of this is self-serving because, you know, I've got right now one child in university, one on the way next year. We've got the RESP, you have done that. But what are the strategies around an RESP that we need to be aware of in terms of contributions, in terms of withdrawals, in terms of, you know, so the any kind of maximizing the benefit of that for our next generation?
Yeah, the RESP has evolved a lot over the years. It used to be very simple many, many years ago, and it's gotten much more complex with the addition of the Canada Education Savings Grants, some provincial grants, the Canada Education Bond. And it's all about trying to maximize the value of the government benefits you're receiving, all those grants and bonds that you're receiving. So if you, and your contribution room, you have a lifetime capital contribution room to your RESP, but you have an annual grant amount that you can receive in maximums. So it's all about trying to maximize those grants and bonds. It's so you want to look at, if you haven't maximized your contributions to the extent of getting your Canada Education Savings Grants this year, you want to look at making that contribution before the end of the year so that you can get accrued bonds or grants this year and then possibly make an additional contribution next year to get whatever may be remaining on the carry forward of those grants. Another opportunity is if you've never opened, for example, an RESP and your child is now the age of 15, so they're turning 15 this year. If you don't open an RESP for them in the year they turn 15 and you don't have one open at all, you won't be able to make contribution and get any government contributions towards that plan in the future. So you really want to make sure that you at least open an RESP in the year the child turns 15, so that then you can actually make some contributions in the years they turn 16 and 17, which is the last year you can contribute, and get some government grants that way. So there is some planning to go around maximizing the value, essentially around what the government is helping you contribute, because those contributions the government is giving you to help your child go to post-secondary education later on is going to help you significantly relative to your contributions into the plan.
And then when we think about that, when it comes time for the beneficiary, my kids or whoever's kids, to go off to school, do we just withdraw the amount in the RESP and that's it? Or are there strategies around that to minimize the tax in, because it's the child that is taxed on the gains. What are some of the, and the government grants, what are some of the strategies around this to perhaps minimize taxation?
But if the child is now registered in a post-secondary educational institution, they can start making withdrawals. The subscriber will decide, of course, being usually the parent, will decide how much the child receives. But the withdrawals of income and grants are paid to the child and they are taxable to the child. And that's where the whole concept of income splitting comes into play. And income splitting is basically trying to take income that would normally be taxed to someone in a higher tax rate and tax it to someone in a lower tax rate. So, for example, if you, instead of using the RESP, Philip, were saving personally in your own hands, it's first of all in a non-registered format, so it's taxable annually on any income it produces, any gains it produces. But that portfolio would now be sitting in your hands and taxable at your marginal tax rate, which in all likelihood is much lower than, or pardon me, yours is much higher than a child who, when they go to start post-secondary education, may have a part-time job, but in all likelihood, their tax rate is quite low. Minimal dollars necessarily is subject to tax. And then they also are entitled to their own personal tax credit. There's the tuition credit. There's possibly an education credit in some provinces that help minimize the tax the child pays. So you want to look at an annual withdrawal in the child's hands that minimizes the tax they pay. So you look at what other sources of income they have, and then you look at what can I withdraw from the RESP from an income and grant perspective and have that tax to the child. The capital that was contributed was not allowed a deduction, so you can get that out tax-free at any time. And if the child is in post-secondary education, the subscriber can take that back for their purposes, but they can also choose to give it to the child. Now, that's tax-free money, so it's not really necessary to plan that, but the longer you leave that invested, the longer it can keep producing some more investment income to pay out to the child. So usually you'll pay out the income of the grants first, and the capital will come out when all of that has been paid out and you may need more funds for the child or the child has finished their studies.
This all sounds, from my perspective, really complicated. You know, we're talking about planning for capital losses and taxation in prior years and future years. We're talking about RESPs and how to withdraw and when to make the contribution, charitable contributions, and so on. This is where really the benefit of you and your team come into play in coordination with our advisors. I mean, this doesn't seem as easy as, you know, me just going on to my computer, go, oh, that's easy, you know, and hitting the easy button and getting this done. Is that a fair assessment that, you know, planning is not easy? Planning is a little bit more complicated than people like to think?
I would definitely say yes. I mean, I might be a little biased being a tax accountant and a financial planner, but when it comes down to it, a lot of this is one of those where you don't try it yourself, right? You don't rely on others who know this area much more than you do. I mean, just like you wouldn't bring your car you'd bring your car to a mechanic to get it fixed because you know your limitations and you may not even be able to fix it, period. You want to work with a planner or your accountant or both to look at every aspect of your plan. And I've been really focusing on tax planning. And again, your focus a lot on is on investment planning. But these are interrelated, and what you do on one side may have an impact on the other. And then that's only some of the elements. Those are two elements of financial planning. I mean, there's essentially a multitude. There's about six total elements of financial planning that come into play. And we're only touching on a few. So dealing with someone who can take a holistic picture and make you look at what you did in the past, for example, the capital losses, carry back, make you look at prior year returns that you probably wouldn't do otherwise. And on the donation side, like you said earlier, it's so easy to just you strike the check. You don't necessarily plan to make the donation, but you should. You should take the time to take a look at what options do you have. Do you have investments with accrued gains? And if you do, pick up the phone, talk to the charity, say, hey, I'm thinking of making, your example from earlier, a $5,000 donation. Would you accept the transfer of these securities over? And in all likelihood, at the beginning when this was all brought in and these rules were brought in, charities were rather hesitant to do this. Nowadays, any at least the bigger charities and even some smaller charities will certainly accept it. And they'll go, yeah, that's good for you and it's good for us. So let's work together. If you are going to do that strategy, though, just a word of caution, as we, December 31st seems far yet, but it's not. And so there's the phone calls, there's a process that has to be followed if you're going to do the in-kind donation, for example. So you want to start that process sooner rather than later. I mean, like any other tax planning, you want to try to start that sooner rather than later. But here you got to work with the institution, you got to work with the donation, the charitable organization to make it work and get it all in time.
And last thing on, I mean, obviously it's not the last thing, but last thing that came to my mind is tax-free savings accounts. Yeah, so we can see with inflation and all that, I think the limit's going up next year. But how important are these, again, to the overall plan?
Overall plan, TFSAs or tax-free savings accounts are quite significant. They've been around now for a while. And you mentioned there's the annual contribution limit that's currently $6,500. But this year is going up to $7,000 next year. And then that means, I mean, again, they've been around for a while. We're in 2023, the cumulative tax-free savings account room since the beginning is $88,000. That means that any Canadian 18 years of age or older would have accumulated room. And if you were 18 when they brought it in or older, you would have accumulated $88,000 of tax-free savings account room, which is a significant amount of dollars. And contributions to the TFSA are not tax deductible, but any withdrawals are tax-free. So your any investment income, any capital gains, and of course your capital, since you didn't get a deduction, can come out tax-free. Keep in mind that if you make a withdrawal from a TFSA, unlike an RSP, where if you make a withdrawal from an RSP, it's taxable and you don't get your contribution room back. If you make a withdrawal from your TFSA in a given year, it gets added back to your TFSA contribution room next year. You don't get it back this year, you get it back next year. So since we're sitting near year end, if you're contemplating making a TFSA withdrawal for whatever purpose, let's say I'm thinking of buying a car in early January, and I'm going to dip into my TFSA knowing that I'll get my contribution room back later, you're better off making the withdrawal towards the end of the 2023 than early 2024, because you'll get your room back earlier. So if I make the withdrawal now, I get my room back in 2024. Versus if I wait till January, make the withdrawal, purchase the car, I won't get my room back till 2025. And if I have some cash that I come into, whether it's my bonus, whether it's inheritance, whether it's whatever excess cash, I can make my contribution back as soon as possible and get that money working for me once again, essentially on a tax-free basis.
And this is all fantastic information. There's a lot that we've covered, but if there were, say, three things that you would want to impress upon clients or anyone out there from a planning perspective, what would they be?
I think the first thing I would tell anyone is don't wait till year end to do your planning. I mean, everybody focuses on year end tax planning. What should I do as I near year end? A lot of tax planning happens throughout the year. And people, in my mind, and in my experience, and I've been doing this for a long time, people think of taxes basically twice a year. I mean, taxes is always a little bit, I hate paying taxes. I worked overtime. They withheld all my paycheck because that's all the taxes I paid, et cetera. But at the end of the, when it comes down to it, people think of taxes at year end because they're trying to think of some year end tax planning they may want to do. And they think of taxes when they prepare their tax return and they go, government's taking all my money. I'm paying all this tax. but they don't do anything about it, right? They don't do anything at that time. Good tax planning is a year-round activity. So simple things, like you said, three things. Simple things like make your RSP contribution early in the year instead of waiting till either the end of the year or the first 60 days of the following year. Because you can make a contribution to an RSP in the calendar year or the first 60 days after the year and deduct them this year. So that can contribute up to the end of February 2024, still deducted 2023. But if I make my contribution in early 2024 or 2024, I've got my money invested so much earlier in a product, in a vehicle that's tax deferred. So why would I defer that? Why am I not doing that earlier? Same thing with your TFSA. Make your contribution early in the year, not late in the year. Withdrawals late in the year, contributions early. That way you maximize the value of what's sitting in your registered plan. And so those are certainly options when you say three things, but that aspect of tax planning is a year-round activity is a concept that seems to escape some people. But little things like that add up, right? Mm. People think, oh, I'm going to save a little bit by making this contribution or this deduction or that deduction. But time value of money, just like in the markets, time value of money is significant, right? Time in the market, not timing the market. Yep. Same thing here. The making sure that you maximize the value by even contributing early versus late in the year or withdrawing late versus early. Do that over 20, 30, 40, 50 years. It all adds up. So I would say get on it now. Start thinking about this year. Don't put it aside until this time next year to think about next year. Roll it into January and start talking to your advisor about what you can do right away.
Perfect, Aurel. I think that's fantastic advice. Before I let you go, I do want to do just a quick lightning round. What we always like to do occasionally when we have a special guest on the podcast is learn a little bit more about you at the personal level. So if you're okay with it, here we go. So first one, what's your go-to comfort food?
I'm a big eater. I'm not a big guy, but I'm a big eater. And in my world, anything that has ketchup on it is great. So ketchup may not be a food. I know you're probably going to tell me that's a condiment. It's not a food. But if it has ketchup on it, that's comfort food to me.
That is the most interesting response I think I've ever gotten on that one. But that's a great one. What was the last movie you saw in the theater?
Oh, my gosh. I have not been since before COVID. I think it was Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. I'm a big superhero fan, so I've seen all the Spider-Man movies, both animated and real life, for lack of a better term, the Batman movies. But yeah, it's been a while since I've stepped into a theater.
Yeah, that was a good one. Okay, and last question: if you weren't being the exceptional tax planner that you are today, what would you be doing?
This is probably, and this throws a lot of people for a loop because I'm a tax professional, right? And there's a stereotypical tax geek, let's say, out there. But I like working on cars. I've spent the last three weekends working on my vehicles and other vehicles. And I think I would probably be a mechanic, which is not what you would assume a tax accountant would tell you.
That's a great, great answer. I love that one. Aurel, thank you so much for joining us on The Living Markets. Your advice is fantastic. And I think just the emphasis on planning, 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 and planning isn't a one-time event. It's an ongoing event throughout the year and throughout our whole life cycle, if you will, or lifetime, whether we're accumulators, decumulators, pre-retirement, post-retirement, saving for our kids' education. It's all about the plan. Thank you for sharing your wisdom with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Philip Peterson, and this has been The Living Market. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please take a moment to rate it or share it with colleagues and friends. It will help other like-minded individuals find us. Thanks for listening.
The content of this podcast, including facts, views, opinions, and recommendations, is not to be used or construed as investment advice and is not an offer or an invitation to buy or sell any security. The content of this podcast should not be relied upon for any purpose, and IG Wealth Management is not responsible for any reliance upon it. This podcast includes forward-looking information that reflects our current expectations or forecasts of future events. Forward-looking information is subject to risks, uncertainties, and assumptions that could cause actual results to differ materially from expressed herein. Our views are subject to change based on market conditions. Commissions, fees, and expenses may be associated with mutual fund investments. Read the prospectus before investing. Mutual funds are not guaranteed, values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated.